I swallow my bite, wash it down with some tea. I thought she was supposed to be Suzanne's friend. Lottie cocks her brassy head to one side and looks at me like I just said something crazy. Ladies like that ain't got no friends, don't you know that? They only got acquaintances they're waiting to turn on. They smile and they smile, just biding their time till there's something to get their teeth in. Looks like it's the missus' turn. I chase a dumpling around my plate, too keyed up to be hungry but not wanting to put Lottie's nose out of joint. It's because of the colored men, isn't it? That's what she meant when she said Henry was the soul of Christian charity. Lottie scowls over her dish tub.
Been talk for weeks now. Nothing but a handful of troublemakers stirring the pot, but they get louder every day. Most folks don't care. They're too busy trying to keep body and soul together to worry what other folks are doing. Not to mention, it's Mr. Henry we're talking about. Not many in this town with a bad word to say against him, coloreds or no coloreds.
I don't say so, but I'm pretty sure Henry's wife is about to have a bad word to say, and I don't envy him one bit. My mind flashes to those church steps, to Mr. Porter and the loaves and the fishes, and all of a sudden I feel a surge of pride to be working in Henry Gavin's home, not because he's an important man, because he's a good man. When I'm finished with supper, I slip up the back stairs, hoping to duck into my room unseen. Instead, I freeze halfway up. Suzanne is standing outside her door, eyes blazing, her chin poked out like a willful child's. Henry stands at the other end of the hall, unshaven and gritty after the long drive back from Smithfield. Not a word has passed between them yet, but there's a tension crackling across that space like the air before a lightning storm, and I know I've blundered into the very skirmish I've been dreading all day. I stand there clutching the banister, afraid to move a muscle. They're too busy locking eyes to notice me pressed back against the wall, halfway up and halfway down. I tell myself I should creep back down to the kitchen, wait until the storm has blown over, but when I hear Henry's voice, my feet root themselves to the floor.
Suzanne, please.
There's no missing the strain in his voice, like he's used to confrontations, and like he's been dreading this one.
Do you think... Maybe you could wait till I've cleaned up and had something to eat before you start in on me.
Suzanne balls her fist and stomps a bare foot on the carpet.
No, I cannot wait, and I'd appreciate it if just for once you'd think of someone besides yourself. You didn't see Celia Cunningham's face yesterday, and me sitting there having to pretend I didn't hear a word she said. This town thinks you've lost your mind, throwing good money after bad on a bunch of tramps, and colored tramps at that.
Henry flinches, and his face goes dark.
They're working men with families to feed, Suzanne, and who I hire is my business.
There's an edge to his voice, something just shy of a warning, but Suzanne isn't put off. Patches of red boil up in her cheeks, down along her slender white throat, and when she finally answers, it's through clenched teeth.
Not when it's ruining my name in this town, it isn't. People are talking, and I don't just mean Celia Cunningham. They know you've taken on twice the men you did last year, and with prices way down, too. That makes you a fool. Fine. I can live with being married to a fool, but what are they going to call you when they find out those coloreds are earning the same wage as white men, taking jobs that belong to whites, taking food out of white children's mouths? Way back when your great-grandfather founded this town, Henry, you've got a duty to set some kind of a standard.
At his side, Henry's fingers curl slowly, crushing the brim of his already battered hat.
That's precisely what I am doing. And it seems to me, if I'm as God Almighty important as you make out, I ought not to have to worry what anybody calls me, especially not the members of the Gavin Ladies Historical Society.
Maybe you should worry about how people treat your wife.
She shrills back, so loud and sharp it makes my scalp prickle. Instead of a bunch of those dark-skinned heathens and their brats. Henry's shoulders sag, as if all of a sudden he's just too tired to keep on.
I'll pay who I like, and I'll feed who I like. Colored or white, it's got nothing to do with you.
And with that, he's gone. In the quiet, I hear the lock turn on his bedroom door, as cold and final as if he had slammed it. For a moment, it's only Suzanne and me standing there, her with her bloodless face, me shaking like a leaf, and I know any minute she's going to see me and realize I've heard every last word. I think about losing my place, about going home to Mama, and I almost hope she does see me. But she doesn't. She only melts back into her room, banging the door shut behind her. The blood seems to have left my legs as I make my way down the stairs. I've just entered the kitchen when I hear Suzanne call for me. I close my eyes and gather my nerves, then grab one of the dark flat bottles from the back of Lottie's pantry. The missus will be wanting a dose of her tincture. She's sitting in the dark when I step into her room, still as death in the small square of moonlight bleeding through the window. She's stripped down to her slip now, her clothes a dark puddle on the carpet, and I see that she's pulled all the pins from her hair. It's standing out from her head like a halo of snakes. The sight of it, of her, makes me shiver. Miss Suzanne? I say soft, like I'm creeping up on something poisonous. Do you want the light? When she doesn't answer, I click on the lamp. I expect to find her crying, but what I find glittering in those icy eyes has nothing to do with tears, and I know then and there that I never want Suzanne Gavin holding a grudge against me. Go down and fetch a bottle from the pantry, Adele. Her gaze falters, skittering away from mine. I spilled the last one. I ignore the lie and point to the bottle sitting next to the lamp. I already brought one. Her eyes touch mine again, a wary look that says, we share a secret, and if I know what's good for me, it'll stay a secret. After a minute, though, they go flat and dull, as if she's somehow looking through me, and for the first time I notice her hands, darting and scratching like a pair of pale, angry birds, raising bloody welts on her wrists. Should I fetch Mr. Gavin? You don't look well. I know, even as I say the words, that Henry's the last person she wants to see, but I have to say something, do something, before she flays herself raw. Her eyes spark to life then, and for the moment her hands are still. Do you know what my husband has been up to, Adele? The knot in my belly tightens. I don't want to hear this, don't want to hear her call Henry a fool again for making sure men can feed their children. My hands are unsteady as I splash a bit of bootleg into her pink teacup. Well, do you? The words are so sharp my head snaps up. I blink at her, trying to think what to say as I work the stopper loose from the little brown bottle and carefully, carefully count out 15 precious drops. He's been hiring colored men. She hollers, so loud I know she means for Henry to hear her clear down the hall. Colored men to work at peak when hard-working white men need jobs. It's a scandal, that's what it is, and it's going to ruin us if he keeps on. I push the cup and saucer into her hands, praying she'll send me away now that she has what she wants. But she's not through. He's making a fool of me, Adele, shaming me and giving gossips like Celia Cunningham fat to chew in front of all my friends and in my own house, too. It's on the tip of my tongue to say that she should be proud of Henry for what he's doing and why he's doing it, and that any decent wife would have told Celia Cunningham so. But in my mind, I see Mama shaking her head, hissing at me to hold my tongue. So I do. It's hard, though. There's a whole lot I'd like to say. She takes a little sip from her teacup and closes her eyes as it goes down, then rattles the cup back into its saucer with a sigh. She must take my silence for sympathy, because she picks up her ranting again, like somehow since dinner we've become bosom friends. I'd like to know what my daddy would say if he had any idea just what kind of man he married me off to. I'll bet he'd say a man's got a duty to care what people think of him. "'Especially when his son's about to be born. "'Don't you think so, Adele?' "'I turn away, pretend to tidy the bed. "'I can't say what I think, and I can't look at her. "'I can see her too clearly now, behind all the anger and the bootleg, "'too grasping and proud to care for a man who won't be tucked in, "'polished up or made over.' It was peak she was chasing after all those years, and peak that she finally married. Henry was only part of the bargain, unworthy in her eyes of her or peak or even his family name. And I see, too, that she's set all her store by the child in her belly, the son she means to bear and mold into all his father is not. She's sipping hard from her cup now, rocking a little from side to side. I think about bringing a cloth to wipe the blood from her wrist, but I don't. Instead, I pick her dress and stockings up off the floor, then tidy up the table by her bed. I asked you a question, Adele. Have you nothing to say? I can feel her eyes boring into my back like a blade, and I turn with her bottle of tincture in my hand, tightening down the stopper and praying she's already swallowed enough to forget what I'm about to say, because suddenly the words are on my tongue and I can't stop them. I think Mr. Henry does a lot of good for folks, and that's something a wife should be proud of. Her eyes go hard as stone. You're taking up for him. She's fuming, but somehow I don't care. It stuns me that she cannot see the good in her husband, and that for all her fancy airs, she's no better than Celia Cunningham. I only said he does a lot of good, the kind of good they preach about on Sundays, and that not a lot of wives have that to be proud of. Proud. Her eyes have gone funny like they do after the tincture, like she expects something to spring at her from one of the corners. I should be proud that my husband is willing to tarnish my good name over a handful of niggers. I go numb all over when she says it. Not what she says, but the way she says it, like it came from the deepest, blackest part of her soul. I don't mean to, or maybe I do. But I let the brown bottle slip from my hand. I don't need to look down to know it smashed. I can smell the foul stuff splattered all over the floor, all over my shoes. And if that isn't enough, the panic in Suzanne's eyes is. It's her last bottle, all the more precious since the doctor cut her back. She's on her feet now, flying across the room, and I steel myself for the crack of her hand. Instead, she collapses to her knees in all the sticky mess and broken glass, crying like it's the end of the world. Chapter 8. Leslie. The door to Henry Gavin's study moaned in oily protest as Leslie turned the knob and pushed inside. Even now, the sound brought a guilty pang. The study, still brimming with the prized collections of her long-dead great-grandfather, had always been strictly off-limits. In fact, in the 8 years she lived at Peak, she'd been allowed into the study exactly 3 times. Aside from a ponderous mahogany desk and an old Victrola her grandfather had cranked up for her once, she had little memory of the room or its contents. It was why she had chosen to start here. She thought it would be easier than Maggie's room, with its drawers full of old slips and nightgowns, its nightstand littered with eyeglasses and hand creams. Now she was beginning to wonder. Inside, all was gloomy and still, the quiet air thick with scents from another era. Leather, tobacco, the musty breath of old books, as if she had breached the sanctity of some long-sealed shrine. And in a way she had. Toward the end of Henry's life, the study had become his sanctuary, the place he spent his days, took his meals, and sometimes even slept, until one morning Maggie had found him slumped behind the desk. After the funeral, the room had been shut up and, as far as Leslie knew, had remained so. Now, as she drew back drapes of heavy brocade and took in her surroundings, it was easy to see why she'd been kept out as a child. This was no place for little hands. Banks of curio cabinets lined two of the walls, one wall dedicated to vintage clocks and antique pens, the other to Henry's cherished pipe collection. A third wall was lined floor to ceiling with books, heavy, leather-bound editions of Cooper, Twain, and Dickens, along with other names she didn't recognize. But it was the ornately framed oils above the fireplace that intrigued Leslie most, perhaps because their less than subtle sensuality was at such stark odds with the rest of the room. There were 5 in all, each hinting at some scriptural event, Delilah with her dagger, Rebecca at the well, but always the same face. Haunting and honey-skinned, with heavy-lidded eyes and a mouth like ready fruit. Leslie gnawed at her thumbnail, letting her eyes move from painting to painting. It didn't fit somehow that a man who had surrounded himself with antiques and classic literature should have a taste for racy art, but then maybe they were worth something. Standing on tiptoe, she attempted to decipher the jaunty ochre strokes at the corner of each canvas, but could make nothing of them. Not that a name would matter. If they weren't Van Gogh or Picasso, she was basically clueless. And these were neither, though they weren't bad. In fact, they were quite good now that she looked at them. Maybe Henry had a better eye for art than she thought. Either way, she was ready to write them off to a personal taste and move on. The massive mahogany desk was still where she remembered it, positioned at the center of the room like a stoic battleship. Leslie eased into the cracked leather chair, placing the flats of her hands on the scarred surface of the desk where the day-to-day business of Peak Plantation had been overseen and tallied. That the room was still furnished with Henry's prized possessions didn't surprise her. In his day, he'd been something of a legend here in Gavin, the man who, with nothing but grit and bare hands, had created a tobacco dynasty and put a tiny town on the map. As she glanced around the room, she thought of Henry, the raw-boned man in the ill-fitting suit who had collected and cherished these treasures over a lifetime. She had never known the man who smoked the pipes or wielded the pens or read the books, but somehow, just by being here, Henry Gavin had become very real. With something like reverence, Leslie eased open the desk's center drawer, fully expecting to find it empty. Instead, she found a smattering of loose change, a pack of old playing cards, a few dusty paper clips, and a wristwatch with a missing strap, as if Henry wasn't dead at all but had only stepped away. The rest of the drawers and compartments housed more utilitarian items, a prehistoric adding machine almost as large as a typewriter, files stuffed with receipts for things like heating oil, truck tires, and plow blades. In the final drawer, she unearthed a stack of cloth-covered ledgers, Peake's accounts from the 30s. Not exactly riveting reading, but maybe the local historical society would be interested in how much bright leaf Peake yielded back in 34. She was about to knee the door closed when she glimpsed what looked like a small book half hidden behind the ledgers. It took some doing to work it free, but finally she had it, a volume of sonnets bound in dark leather. The embossing on the front cover had long since worn away, but along the spine the name Barrett Browning was thinly visible. Poetry, too, then. It appeared Henry Gavin was truly a Renaissance man. When the pages parted unexpectedly to reveal a delicate spray of dried flowers, Leslie's mouth parted in a silent O. Instinctively, her fingers sought the pale petals, paper thin and long bled of color, trying to guess what their original hue had been, yellow, perhaps, or pink. It was impossible to say. Had they been placed between these pages for a reason, she wondered, or had the pages been chosen at random? Curious, she slid the flowers aside to read the marked passage. "How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach when feeling out of sight for the ends of being and ideal grace. I love thee to the level of every day's most quiet need by sun and candlelight. I love thee freely as men strive for right. I love thee purely as they turn from praise. I love thee with the passion put to use in my old griefs and with my childhood's faith. I love thee with a love I seemed to lose with my lost saints. I love thee with the breath, smiles, tears of all my life, and, if God choose, I shall but love thee better after death." The final lines echoed in Leslie's head as she read them. She had never cared much for poetry, but something about the words of love and loss seemed to resonate deep down in her bones, and she knew as she closed the book on those faded petals that the words had not been so tenderly marked for nothing. Turning to the front cover, she found what she was looking for. For Henry, on his birthday. There was no signature, but the hand was almost certainly a woman's, thin and delicately slanted, more than likely belonging to Henry's wife, Suzanne. Seeking confirmation, she flipped over to the back page and, instead, found a photograph. With ginger hands, she slid it free and tipped it to the light. It was a portrait, a woman stiffly posed with a baby in her arms. She wore neat white gloves with her simple dress